Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 415th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia in Canada. You know the rest of it, somewhere in the world.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and the director of program and practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada. I'm also a professor, not the professor.
In your mind, you're the professor. And when he says the professor, he means from Gilligan's Island.
That's right. From the University of Alberta.
And for those of you who have no idea what I just mentioned, you're way too young.
Yeah. And also we're both members of Peer, yeah. the Peer group. So anyhow, James, depression, this is getting me down. We've got to get through this series. Well, yeah. I think we've got one more and we'll let people be free.
Yeah.
And then it's back to premium stuff.
Yeah. So just to recap, we did a little bit on what questions to ask. We talked about which antidepressants are the most effective. We talked about dosing and stuff. And now we're going to go to talking about, is there stuff that we can, can we combine antidepressants? Can we add things to antidepressants and so on?
Right. And so one of the things that kind of caught me off guard about this was, I was at a talk and one of our colleagues, David from Halifax, said, David Gardner,
yeah,
he
David
said
Gardner, yeah.
Yeah, that there was a trial showing early augmentation, or sorry, just combining right off the hop is maybe better. And I then looked up this and I was presenting some of the same stuff. And he later told me, oh, Mike, data's changed.
Yeah.
So thank you for that. I'm kidding. But he's exactly right. So early on, there was some data suggesting that combining antidepressants like mirtazapine with fluoxetine or venlafaxine or whatever would be better than fluoxetine alone. And remission rates looked like they were way better with a number needed to treat of 4. But then a study came out that's far bigger with 6. That was with 100 people. This one's with 600. And it looked at combining mirtazapine again versus others, and it found there was really no effect. In fact, the remission rates were 38 or 39% across the board for 4 groups, and response was stable at about 50%. So,
which is exactly what you'd get with one.
I know. And
I'm just right. I know you knew that, Mike. I'm mentioning it to our audience that's why we do these podcasts.
Right.
Yes. It's not all about you.
So really, I think it's no, there's no clear indication to think that you're going to start with 2 right off the hop. And let's jump to the whole idea of antipsychotics. They got a lot of popularity and for the idea of augmenting. So let's talk about where the evidence is for that. So antipsychotics versus antidepressants has been studied a couple times, and it's I would say equivalence is far from certain. Quetiapine really just one study, and although it was equivalent, that to me one study in this kind of genre doesn't really make or break anything. Mm-hmm. Olanzapine had 5 trials, and in 2 of them, antidepressants were better, and 3, there was no difference. And if we remember right back to the beginning with antidepressants, you can recall that about 50% of the studies submitted to FDA showed that antidepressants were better than placebo, but almost 50% showed they were not better than placebo. So if we take that in context of this, saying about half the trials show equivalence and half show antidepressants are superior, I would lend to the idea that antidepressants alone are superior to antipsychotics alone. Mm-hmm. Now, there is a study of quetiapine, not head-to-head, but quetiapine versus placebo for depression, and the number needed to treat are very similar to what you'd expect from antidepressants. That doesn't mean that we can translate that to equivalence to antidepressants, but it is reassuring.
Yeah. And that was 4 trials combined.
Yeah,
to 2,000
exactly.
Patients. Yeah.
So I'm
and in fact, if you remember, if you go way back in time, we had a podcast entitled "Our Top 20 Medications of Which Ones We Would Choose," and quetiapine was one of the ones that we chose because you could maybe get an antipsychotic effect and an antidepressant effect as well. But
right,
yeah,
exactly.
But that's so certainly suggestion. I mean, 4 trials of 2,000 patients suggest that it has an effect.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. Just I don't think. And the equivalence, I don't think with olanzapine you could say they're equivalent, but with quetiapine, given one trial showing head-to-head that they were similar, plus four versus placebo, it's more reassuring. But I certainly wouldn't start with quetiapine for me personally as a prescription for patients because its adverse event profile is quite high and let's move on. And so what about augmenting when you start with an antidepressant and as we said, except in cases where, you know, it's quite severe or you see no benefit, you've waited your kind of 12 weeks and now you're thinking, boy, we need to do a little something extra here. So this is, these are 12 trials and it's of aripiprazole, olanzapine, quetiapine, risperidone. So three of the ones are, I would say all of them are used, some more than others. And the response rates were, these are people, don't forget, who haven't already responded. Response rate NNTs of kind of 7 to 12. So, you know, somewhere in that 10% absolute benefit and remission, a similar number, 7 to 12. So about a 10% remission improvement, which is, these are, to me, that is considerable. And it lends to the idea that it's not a bad idea to consider augmenting with antipsychotics. And the good thing, as we talked about already about dosing, is some of them can be given at quite low doses. And I certainly, I don't really push doses in these. I'm often, if I'm using something like quetiapine, it's kind of 25 to 50 milligrams often is kind of the bigger dose that I go to. So really, in many ways, many people might think of it as a whisper of a dose, but still, I've seen success in practice with that. Adverse events are what you'd expect and what you'd expect from the main culprits. So like olanzapine, as we know, causes weight gain and the average is 4 kilograms, but in many patients it can be across the board. So that's 4 kilograms across the board, but some will get very minimal weight gain and some will get very large weight gain. Yeah. And how many will have to stop due to adverse events? The number needed to harms there are 6 to 13, so around 10 again if used alone, and how many will have to stop in augmentation, and that is between 12 and 50. So much less in augmentation, but again, that's because we're using lower doses often in augmentation.
And the number of people who are stopping due to adverse events, that's not that different than what you'd see with just antidepressants.
Yes, absolutely right. So the Canadian and American Depression Guidelines say you can use second generation antipsychotics alone or as augmentation for those who failed first line antidepressants. So this is kind of, so the way they're suggesting is you try antidepressants first. If they fail, you can either give the antipsychotic alone, and that would probably be quetiapine as the best evidence. And if not, use it as an augmentation, which is the way I tend to use them if I use them in depression.
Well, and I'm hoping, I mean, if the person truly has had no response to the first line antidepressant, I'm hoping people are stopping those.
Yeah, and then trying something else.
Yeah, because if you're not getting anything, I mean, I think you don't, that's not the time where you augment. It's where you haven't had a complete response. You might want to add something.
Yeah, not a good response, but you're getting something, but just not good. So let's talk about something that I know is near and dear to your heart and is tricky in practice, and that is the separation.
Are you talking about depression? Or are you talking about, you know, life
relationships,
life relationships,
and jobs and stuff
and
like
jobs,
that?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, James, we're not going to go into that aspect of the psychosocial elements that permeate through depression. We're going to stick to drugs.
And all I'm asking, you're not leaving me, are you?
This is how it happens. I told you if I was going to do that, it'd be by text.
Yeah. Because if you're leaving me, I'm leaving you first.
Okay, so let's, before this degrades any further, let's talk about what the research shows. So there's a meta-analysis of 31 trials. And What they did in this is they stopped after 4 to 28 weeks, but the average was between 6 and 16 weeks. And then they reassessed people at 12 months. So this is a good long time. So this was a withdrawal trial, which means that, you know, James, you'd be going along, you've had a response, and then after 10 weeks or so, we switch you to placebo and mm-hmm. we see how you do at 12 months. And those who were switched at that kind of 6 to 16 or 10 weeks, if you like, that kind of window, 41% in the placebo group had a relapse versus 18% in the continuation arm. So these are people who've already seen a benefit, so we know it's probably working for them. That's the important thing. Why?
Well, no. But with the caveat, we don't know if it's the drug that's working on. They had a response,
right? Yeah. But they had a response, and that's why you see, if you look at the relapse kind of thing the other way, mm-hmm. in the treatment arm, 70 or 82% are relapse free or free of depression at that point. So that's the reason is because these withdrawal trials are all like that. If you look at the withdrawal trials of the cholinesterase inhibitors for dementia, they always look really good because you've selected people who you saw were getting a response. Mm-hmm. And as James said, a response in some way, but they were getting better. So the number needed to harm for stopping early was 5 in that case. The dose reduction studies, very similar design, where kind of after a while they have a reduced dose and then see how they do. And they found that the people who were switched to a lower dose had their dose dropped. 25% of them went into a relapse versus 15% who stayed on their dose. So not a big difference, but still about a number needed to harm of 10. And again, that's 15% are having a relapse in the treatment arm, which means 85% of them continue to do well, but it's because they've been pre-selected. So,
yeah. But it means that 90% of people will have the same response on a lower dose.
Yeah. Well, because they're either going to have a relapse.
Yeah.
And nothing can prevent
yeah.
that. Or they're going to not have a relapse, but it will make a difference. And so this has armed me to allow me to talk to patients a little bit more who want a dose reduction or what have you. And certainly, you know, this is where you have to put on the clinician's hat. So why do you want a dose reduction? Well, I'm feeling fuzzy during the day and I'm wondering whether it's the drug or something. And mm-hmm. those cases, sure, you know the risks and benefits. And as you say, it's about a 10% absolute difference. So maybe in those cases, it's worth a dose reduction and seeing if the dose reduction can stop whatever perceived adverse event there is there. But I just worry what the drug's doing to me or that kind of thing. Yeah. Then I try and dissuade them from quitting or reducing the dose because I know their relapse rates and are definitely higher. So it requires that, you know, clinician kind of approach, which we are paid to do. this does give you that information that you need to help make those decisions. And the last thing is there's kind of other research showing a very similar thing. So the chances of having a relapse, this was from 54 RCTs, was 22% if you stayed on versus 44% if you quit early. So this just is, so how long is these trials? Well, they're 12 months, which is often that time frame that we say, why don't you try and stay on? We don't have ones that go longer, but we do have some data. And that data is from cohorts. And this is the best one that I think I've found. And it has 318 patients, many who've had previous depression. And what it found was after a year or so, 25% will have some kind of recurrence of their depression. They've gone a year and then they stop. And then after one more year, 25% have had a recurrence. If you go another year after that, 41% have had a recurrence. And basically you add on about 15% every year for recurrence. But at the end of 5 years, 36% of patients had not had a recurrence. And they said the biggest predictor, of course, is repeat recurrences. So if you're someone who've had 3 episodes or 2 episodes of depression in the past, your chance of having a relapse is much higher. And in those patients, it's more reasonable to think about, should you be on this long term?
Yeah, no, exactly. So again, that's just using common sense. Now we're out of the realm of where we don't really have the studies to guide us. And it's just using common sense and, you know, clinical acumen and all those sorts of things.
We have, you know, we have a bit of research to guide us with that study. And that they do have relapses, but it is like you say. So there's some data that stopping early and earlier than a year can increase the risk of relapse, but and certainly dose reductions can have a smaller effect, but it's all balanced against adverse events and all of that. And then for the people with lots of recurrences, this is the ammunition that I have when I discuss with them the chance to stay on this, or the options of staying on it long-term to prevent these recurrences. And I do advocate for that, particularly in those who've had a real struggle with depression throughout their lives. And in most cases, patients will opt for that. If they've, I've had lots of patients in my career who've really, really struggled, and it maybe took one or two episodes in a row for them to get there, but they have gotten there and seen a good response. In fact, I've had patients who, you know, will come in and say to me, you know, I wanted to see if I could go off, and I knew this might happen. Right. So here I am. I need to get back on something again.
Yeah.
And so it's an experiment for them too. I think you and I are both the same, James. We would rather not have to take anything if we didn't have to.
Yeah.
So they wanted to see. And it's just, you know, for some people they need thyroid medicine. Some people need blood pressure medicine. So I don't see this as that different. Some people are cursed by having recurrent depression, and the medicines can help prevent that. And especially if they have no or minimal adverse events, it can be reasonable.
Yeah. And so one of the questions that people often ask about this is like, you may have heard of this, Mike. Some people go through withdrawal from SSRIs.
Yeah, and SNRIs.
I mean, anything that starts with the SS, although I probably shouldn't say that, but you know. But it's actually hard to sort of get numbers for that. There's a number of cohort trials that have looked at it, but if you read guidelines, you know, they will often say, yeah, you know, some people struggle getting off of them, but most people don't, and they almost leave it at that. But I've recently looked at this, and I'm going to give you some numbers that you can relatively hang your hat on. If you have about 100 people who are on an SSRI and you're trying to get them off. Now, this is not for recurrence or whatever. This is just going through a withdrawal from the SSRI. About 50% of people will not experience withdrawal symptoms. So they almost literally can just stop the medication and not get that. Now, we don't know what 50% that is, so we're not saying you should just stop them. We'll talk about that in just a minute. So 50% won't experience any withdrawal symptoms, but about 50% will develop some degree of withdrawal symptoms. Of those 50 people, that's 50% of the 100, about half of those people will experience severe withdrawal symptoms. And I'm sure you've seen that happen, Mike.
For sure.
Yeah. And this is the concern that people have with using SSRIs, is that they are difficult to get off. And then another sort of 10 to 15 of the 50, so another sort of the people who experience symptoms, about a quarter of them will experience moderate withdrawal symptoms, and about a quarter will experience mild withdrawal symptoms. So that's the best numbers I can come up with. And again, you'll never know who that person is going to be, but you might be able to use those numbers to talk about, if you are going to stop it, that this is where we may go with this. And then, so that's the sort of the frequency of the withdrawal symptoms. And then when you look at the duration of it, the average duration, it's actually quite unclear to get this information, but it seems to be about 5 to 10 days. But, and I know you probably had patients, but there are many reports suggesting that for some patients that symptoms can last weeks to months. So, you know, it is very tricky to know what to do with that. But that's the best information that I could find about antidepressant withdrawal and how many people experience sort of what we classify as sort of the withdrawal symptoms. You know, and when we're talking about that, I mean, there's a gamish of symptoms that we're talking about. I mean, nausea, diarrhea, abdominal pain, electric shock-like feelings,
yes,
visual after images, sound and light sensitivity, muscle aches and pains, chills, confusion, pounding heart. I mean, you just pretty much list any sort of withdrawal symptom, and you can get that from coming off of these medications. And so, I'm sure you probably remember, Mike, we talked about, we did a project together called MedStopper, where we tried to identify, try to provide some guidance as to how do you stop medications. And to the best of my knowledge, there are clinical trials of tapering, but there's no clinical trials showing what's the best way to do it. And I just thought, mm-hmm, I'd let the audience know about, this is how a group of people who got together said that they would try to withdraw people from at least antidepressants. And this is what we came up with. If they're used daily for more than about 3 to 4 weeks, and obviously that's just a guide, you reduce the dose by 25% every week. So first of all, you go to 75%, then 50, then 25. However, that can be extended or decreased depending on whether they start to get symptoms. And you may have to go to a much slower dose reduction. And so instead of 25, you go to 10% dose reductions. And so the suggestion that these people who have had experience doing this is that you usually start to see withdrawal symptoms about 1 to 3 days after dosage change. And if you start to see that, you should probably go back to the previous tolerated dose, and then instead of cutting it by 25%, maybe cut it by 10%. And you just keep going and going until you can get the person off the medication, but you may not be able to get everybody off the medication. And that's sort of the approach that I think can work, and how to sort of do it and what sort of symptoms to look out for.
Yeah, it's tricky though. If you're on, let's say, 40 of a medicine, to get to it, you can often get to kind of 75% of that at a 30 milligram dose, but to get to 35 milligrams from 40 is tricky a lot of the time.
Oh yeah, no.
And you're doing things like alternating days, and all sorts of stuff.
And I've seen in the one trial, and I know this trial has not been published, the one trial that looked at getting people off fluoxetine. I think they took people who were on SSRIs and then switched them all to fluoxetine and then tried to taper them off it. Because you've probably heard that, because fluoxetine has a long half-life, it's easier to taper. Yeah. And that, it's still tricky to taper off of that medication, let alone anything else. Yeah. And what they were able to do with that in those patients, again, the majority of them, you could taper them off by doing the approach that we said. But I know in talking to the lead investigator of that trial, they said, we use liquid fluoxetine so we could really adjust the dose. And I think in the relatively, hopefully, small percentage of people who get into troubles with reducing dose by 25%, that might be an approach to go to, because there really is no other way. And not all of the medications, as can be, you can certainly cut tablets or in quarter, but again, not all of them come as tablets and all that sort of stuff. So that's just an approach that can be used.
Absolutely. And one of the leads in this area is actually a primary care clinician, and she's works at McMaster, originally from New Zealand, Dee Mangan. We're actually going to have her at the PIPE conference next year talking about this very topic. How do you, what are the adverse events or what are the challenges in withdrawal from antidepressants, and how do we manage that in clinical practice?
She's done all, so much of the evidence in this area, and actually also in stopping medications for lots of things. But she plays a major role in if anyone knows anything about this, it's her.
Yeah, exactly. And we're surprised she still stoops to our level, but she does. She will slum around with us at conferences and stuff like that.
Yeah. You get her a drink. She's fine. No, she's a good friend. We're good friends. We went to New Zealand and did some talks with her there. And she's a great clinician and one of the best primary care researchers that I know.
Yeah, you're exactly right, James. So we were kind of joking about her slumming around with us and all that kind of thing. But she did win the Donald Rice Award just this year. And it's only given out every 2 years, and it's to the top primary care researcher in Canada. It's awarded from the College of Family Physicians of Canada. So she is deservedly so, very well recognized for her work in multiple areas in primary care.
Yeah. So we've got a few more things to talk about. We're just going to do a little bit of non-medication treatment.
Right. And so let's just talk a little bit. Everyone talks about counseling and particularly CBDs or CBD.
CBT.
Yeah.
A bit of a slip of the tongue on that one, Mike.
Yeah. Because I end up talking on that so much. So what it looked like, we talked about standard mean differences, and a lot of them are pooled like that because so many different scales are used in everything. But it looked just dynamite in the original research, a 0.77 standard mean difference, which means a pretty impressive effect in improving response rate. But it was haunted by a lot of different problems. They were studied versus wait list versus rather than placebo, and wait list in itself is kind of depressing. There's lots of heterogeneity. So once they said, well, what if you get some form of attention, like just even follow up with your family doctor or something, or if the depression is severe, well, then the effect didn't seem as good. And so once you started to add in some of the control factors, the effect dropped from 0.77 to 0.28, which means a small effect, which is very similar to what you see with, drugs. The effect is often kind of, again, in that same standard mean difference, somewhere around 0.7 to 0.4, or somewhere in the kind of 0.5 to 0.3, and it gets a little less when you start to control for some of the issues. But what we're talking about here is, I think you could say it's pretty similar to antidepressants in effectiveness. Mm-hmm. And not for very severe depression, obviously it's a different matter, but for mild and moderate, quite effective. And for me, if patients are willing to go, and I've even, you know, I guess one of the things that surprises me frequently is how many patients refuse to go or don't go versus are more willing to take drugs for mild to moderate depression, even when it's covered.
Yeah.
So,
but I mean, in not in the defense, but I mean, if it was as simple as it's just easier to take a pill. I mean, if you could take it without side effects and get the same effect, and I'm the last one to probably promote using medication, but I totally understand that. So I'm not obviously saying that, you know, CBT shouldn't be used. I'm just saying one can appreciate why if one could believe that you could just take a pill, that you would do that because it's easier. But yeah, no, for sure, CBT therapy is an important component of this, and maybe in combination, you know, especially in, you know, moderate to severe, where if you can get things that will help people, you know, cognitively work out their depression, I think far better than using a medication because of the risks.
Yeah, for whenever you can, and depending on what the patient, as we talked about in every podcast, just about what they want. Mm-hmm. The last piece that I think deserves mention, and you'll maybe be a little bit surprised that I've waited this long, is exercise. So there is some studies of exercise for depression, and of course this would be mild to moderate because it's hard to get people moving who are, you know, suffering from anhedonia, etc. But there are 23 trials, and of course they have a massive standard mean difference, which is almost certainly exaggerated at 0.8 or so. Mm-hmm. But if you focus on the best ones, it's very much what the antidepressants and the CBT show, and it's somewhere around about a 0.4 standard mean difference, number needed to treat somewhere around 10, which is exactly what we see with drugs. Again, these are mild to moderate, but it does encourage us that it's a good, at least at a minimum, kind of augmentation and something we should bring up with patients.
Yeah, and I was going to suggest in the context of this whole exercise and your comment about how, you know, we can't, you know, if they're severely depressed, you know, it's going to be tricky to get them to do any of this. Go back to the podcast, and I don't remember the exact number that we talked about with Bruce Earle, where we talked about some really interesting discussions that we had around, you know, not calling people depressed, but just saying that they're stuck. And then he said he's had a fair amount of sort of experience and also success with sort of making deals with patients to say, you know, let's not try to get, you can't just say, why don't you go and exercise? You know, you sort of got to come up with some ideas about, you know, what are you likely to do in the next week? And he sort of uses a threshold of 70%, you know, would you go out and go for a walk every other day over the next week? Is there a 70% chance you'll do that? Because if they tell you no, it's about 10%. There's no, why set everything up for failure? So if you get a chance, go back and listen to that podcast with him, because I think it was really useful in the way he sort of put the non-drug treatments into perspective. And I thought it just, if you remember, Mike, it was a really good discussion.
Yeah, yeah, no, it was good. I like his 70%.
Yeah.
Do you think there's, and if they say it's, no, there's about a 10% chance, just forget it.
Don't, yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, even at 70%, you're still not going to get there, but you're not going to get, yeah, everyone doing it. But, you know, that's the approach that I think would be a good thing to sort of get them to do a buy-in. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. And so the last thing is a study that I thought was really, and I think Tina Koronik was the first one to point this study to me, but it's a study of 460 women, and they were randomized to these are not depressed women. These are patients, and they're just trying to improve quality of life. And I think they were kind of in their 50s, 60s. And they were randomized to three levels of activity, zero activity, and then three levels. And the levels went by level two, which is the middle level, was the one that what's recommended, kind of 30 minutes of exercise most days of the week. Mm-hmm. And then the first level was kind of half of that, and the highest level exercise was one and a half that. So 45 minutes of exercise basically every day of the week. And what they found is they looked at quality of life on eight different measures, mental and physical. And what I found fascinating about this is, James, you know that dose response curves are not linear. They're curved so that they're front loaded on low dose and then doubling, quadrupling the dose to eight times the dose gives very marginal benefit for most drugs. But in the quality of life exercise study, what they found was dose of exercise had a linear relationship with quality of life. So if you did more exercise, a little bit more, you improved a little bit, then you kind of doubled that with the next level and doubled it again. So it was this kind of very kind of steady, responsive kind of 10 to anywhere from 2 to 10% for each increment you go up, of exercise, you increase. And that was for 7 out of 8 quality of life measures.
Yeah, which is just fairly impressive.
That there's nothing in the drug world that does that kind of improvement. So it's just another encouragement for us to advocate for this. And I know it's frustrating in practice, but it's a very reasonable thing for us to do, given the evidence is quite strong.
So we're going to now sum up everything, because we've taken you on a trilogy, I think. Is it a trilogy or quadrology? I'm not sure which one.
It's the latter, the quadrology. Yeah, yeah.
So of depression. So we're going to sort of just give you some tips and suggestions to how to go through this whole process.
Right. So first, two questions can help exclude depression. And we've gone through those a couple times. So consider using those. 50 to 60% of people in primary care given an antidepressant will have a good response. And the severity has the biggest impact in the effect over and above placebo. But as far as what we say, about 50 to 60% of patients on average. There's no clear evidence that one antidepressant is better than another, except for maybe in the adverse events and the response for individual patients, but not on not randomized control trial data.
Now, before you get to the next step, because I want to just sort of pick your brain a little bit, and then I'll give my 1 cent's worth of useful information. But so, given that, how do you decide which antidepressant to use?
I have 8 of them on a board on sticky notes, and then I throw a dart at it with my eyes closed. I just ask the patient to cover themselves safe.
No, I don't. Because 50% of the time you hit the patient.
So I have 2 or 3 that I use regularly, and I leave it up to the I have a quick conversation with the patient. I find that a lot of patients are really quite worried about weight gain, so I often use fluoxetine out of the box. So that's often my go-to. But my second go-to would be citalopram, and I don't believe this is necessarily the case, but I'll tell patients that there's a discussion that it has less adverse events. So, and there is some evidence, as terrible as it is, that suggests that might be the case, but I don't believe it makes a difference, but I know that that's what patients hear or can hear. So I provide that information. I tell them they're all about the same in effectiveness and that we may have to try multiple ones before we find the right one for you. I remember a guy took 4 different antidepressants over the span of a year before we got one. And it did, when he got it, 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 if we assume it's, if it's it.
If it's it, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it worked like dynamite.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Anyway, go ahead.
And then, I don't disagree because, you know, fluoxetine has some advantages as far as how you can dose it and all that, which then leads me to the question of, then, given that we talked a little bit about the dosing of it, that it doesn't make a heck of a lot of difference. I mean, there's a variety of different approaches of one could start. I just wanted to see, like, to me, it would make, one of the things that you don't want to do is blow them away with side effects. So I'm not...
10 to 20 is what I start. 10 to 20 is where I start for any of those. And I pick those medicines too, because they all have the same kind of dosing, mm-hmm. which is very convenient for me with my small mind. So I gravitate towards those. It's not that I don't use ones like sertraline with other types of dosing, but I stick to ones that I'm really comfortable with knowing the dosing. And I would
suggest is literally, I mean, I know you said the, you know, the typical thing, 10 to 20. I don't see any reason to start with 20. I mean, there's no reason why would you not just start with 10, because there is some marginal evidence of that process. And, you know, you really do want to reduce the risk of side effects, because one of the concerns is if they get side effects, they'll stop the medication. So, you know, that's, and there is no, I'm not saying that, you know, another approach could be is that, you know, you talked about that you can't get 5 milligrams of fluoxetine because it, you know, there isn't a dosage form for that. But, you know, what you could easily do is take, you could, if people were really worried about side effects or really concerned about it, you could start off with say 10 milligram and give that every other day. Now, you know, that would then give you sort of 5 milligrams a day. And, you know, fluoxetine has a, you know, a long half-life and blah, blah, blah. And I'm not suggesting that that would be the dose that you, the final dose that you get them on. But one of the key things is, like we've talked about, is we want to make sure they tolerate the medication. So maybe you could try 10 milligrams every other day. And then, you know, once they tolerate it, you know, you could go to 10 milligrams a day. There's no studies that are going to guide us, other than we do know that there are some studies suggesting that lower doses work.
Yeah. Yep. So I use often kind of, 20 milligrams of fluoxetine and 10 milligrams. That's kind of the quarter of the maximum dose. And that's often the only place I really go. And we talked about weight loss. There is studies of weight loss with fluoxetine, but the studies that did that were mostly in diabetics, and mostly they gave 60 to 80, which I can't remember. There's probably someone that I've given that dose to in my career, but I can't remember that. Yeah. That's probably beaten dose to death.
And then
antidepressants work in about 7 days, and they can take up to 3 months, though, that 12 weeks to see response. Dosing and switching, like doubling the dose and all that, should not be done too quickly, because the evidence is it's taking them 3 months to get those responses. So for some that are showing some signs of recovery early, but...
And if you're not getting a response to whether you started with 10 or 20, you're not going to probably get that any benefit from going from 20 to 40 or whatever,
or 80
or 80. Yeah. If you're just being mean.
Yeah. If you're just being mean. And though, it is reasonable to switch and augment, and the choices are quite variable, and there is no exact recipe. And we talked about the benefits of antipsychotics. Patients should likely stay on their meds around 12 months if they can tolerate them. And if they have recurrent episodes, it's reasonable to consider long-term therapy. CBT is similarly effective to antidepressants based on the best available evidence. And don't forget to get patients active.
Yeah. And I like the fact that you use the word active instead of, doing exercise, because I think, you know, there's a subtle nuance between the difference between those two too. So it's all about being physically active and doing things that you enjoy. And I know you enjoy doing all sorts of things, like we talked about before the podcast, of doing stuff outdoors and building stuff and digging holes and all that sort of stuff.
I do.
And that's you know, that's a definitely a form of exercise, as you know.
Yes, for sure.
Yeah. So I don't think we have anything to sell, other than we would love it if you would subscribe to our premium podcast, if you could, to help us out. That would be brilliant. Continue to try and get to the Tools for Practice, because they're coming out every 2 weeks. And there's some just gems that have just been released recently, and I'd suggest you guys go check those out. And I think we'll leave it at that. So thanks, as always, for listening.
Talk to you later.